It's Thursday, January 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States vows a commitment to security with South Korea and Japan after North Korea's claim that it has tested a hydrogen bomb. An analyst comments.
The United States Congress, especially the Republican opposition, is looking very seriously at some sanctions legislation that would impose Iran-type financial sanctions against the North Koreans.
Chinese regulators shut down trading on the country's financial markets, and we'll hear about this year's Consumer Electronics Show underway in Las Vegas. It's all ahead. The United States and its two key Asian allies, Japan and South Korea, are pledging what a South Korean official calls the most powerful and comprehensive sanctions against North Korea following its fourth nuclear test Wednesday. President Obama discussed the matter by phone with South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. South Korea also announced a resumption of cross-border propaganda broadcast the North has previously called an act of war. Wednesday, the UN Security Council held an emergency session on what amounts to another violation by Pyongyang of previous Council sanctions following its tests in 2006, 2009, and 2013. Elbio Roselli is the Uruguayan ambassador to the UN and current Council president.
The members of the Security Council strongly condemned this test, which is a clear violation of Security Council Resolutions 1718 of 26, 1874 or 20 of 9, 2087 of 2013, and 2094 of 2013, and of the non-proliferation regime, and therefore a clear threat to international peace and security continues to exist. The members of the Security Council also recalled that they have previously expressed their determination to take further significant measures in the event of another DPKR nuclear test. And in line with this commitment and the gravity of this violation, the members of the Security Council will begin to work immediately on such measures in a new Security Council resolution.
Korea expert David Straub of Stanford University welcomes the Council's early and tough response, but tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he doubts it will resort to the kind of economic sanctions that appeared to be effective in drawing Iran to the negotiating table over its own nuclear program.
I'm very doubtful that China and Russia, which have veto power on the Council, will agree to such strong measures. I think they will probably agree to significantly strengthen sanctions, but won't go for an all-out financial war against North Korea. However, the United States Congress, especially the Republican opposition, is looking very seriously at some sanctions legislation that would impose Iran-type financial sanctions against the North Koreans.
Well, they seem to work the last time the Bush administration used them late in that administration.
Well, that's the conventional wisdom. And it certainly angered the North Koreans. But I myself have never seen proof that it really seriously affected the North Korean economy. But it did certainly make the North Koreans very angry.
Those sanctions also could hurt Chinese banks, so they could have a ripple effect beyond North Korea.
That's right. And that's part of the reason I believe the Chinese will not support those sanctions in the UN Security Council. The United States government also has to weigh this very carefully. If it goes for these types of sanctions and in the process really upsets the Chinese, that could affect U.S. cooperation with China, not only on other aspects of the North Korean nuclear issue, but also on all the many other issues on the U.S.-China agenda.
David Straub believes the North Korean leadership hopes to leverage its nuclear capability as part of a policy to sow discord between the U.S. and South Korea with the ultimate goal of controlling the peninsula. As for North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, Straub says any lingering hope he was a youthful reform leader has been dashed. He says the nuclear test coupled with leadership purges and executions show him to be ruthless and unscrupulous and a danger to regional peace and stability. Stephen Norper of the New York-based Korea Society says what is significant about the latest nuclear test is not whether it was a hydrogen blast or boosted atomic explosion, but the modernization process apparently underway in North Korea.
The idea of miniaturization and enhanced capabilities can pose a real threat, both in terms of security, and it limits the types of responses that can be made in the international arena, and it pushes us to an area where military responses are considered more thoroughly. And so that raises the stakes all around. So it could be considered normal nuclear development, but it's a dangerous, dangerous game.
How serious a setback is this for global anti-proliferation efforts, given the July nuclear agreement with Iran?
It's a setback, certainly. The emphasis and the push really should be toward nuclear non-proliferation, if not the stated goal of denuclearization. And that's should still remain probably the more realistic goal at this point. But limiting DPR capabilities is really at the fore of priorities, not just for nations like South Korea, the United States, and Japan, but really and increasingly for countries like China. China's the largest loser in this particular case. Chinese citizens are very frightened of nuclear fallout from North Korea. You will see, I'm sure, an amassing of PLA forces toward the border in coming days. And the Chinese have very vociferously, through their foreign ministry, condemned this test. And the Xi Jinping administration appears, frankly, to really be at a very strong breaking point with North Korea over this. We'll have to see how far that goes.
And Stephen Norper of the Korea Society says concerns over the North's nuclear direction over the next 10 to 20 years, if left unchecked, could give new impetus to restarting suspended six-party talks on denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. For reaction on social media, I'm joined now by International Edition's Olin Akashoglu.
Hi, Sarah. Yesterday, I talked about how a lot of social media users started making fun of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un after news spread that they were claiming that the North Koreans were claiming to have detonated a hydrogen bomb. And some people actually took the jokes pretty far. Internet users created a business on Google Maps for the bomb's test site in North Korea and started posting satirical reviews. One person even uploaded a picture of Mordor, the evil fortress from the Lord of the Rings movies, as the site's background image. Google has since removed the reviews, but Reuters published several of them in an article, so I'm going to read a few of them that were recorded. According to Reuters, David Day gave the test site one star and wrote, "Been here 1 week, have yet to develop the promised superpowers of Spider-Man and the Incredible Hulk." Another user, Tristan Hughes, rated it 5 stars and wrote, "The staff had a sort of glowing persona about them, and even the loudest of noises don't seem to bother anyone." So once again, internet users are continuing to take attempts to get attention in North Korea, not very seriously.
Okay, well, what else is trending?
A big trend here in the U.S. is the phrase $675 million. That's the value of this Saturday's Powerball lottery, and it's the biggest Powerball jackpot so far after there was no winner declared Wednesday night. Lots of people are tweeting about the lottery saying they're going to go out and buy a ticket. This could be their big shot. But according to CNN, the odds of winning the Powerball Wednesday were 1 in 192 million. So it's probably still a long shot for most people. I'm sure those odds aren't getting any better.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Thanks very much. That's International Edition's Olin Akashoglu. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A couple of British scientists have found that winds of over 2 kilometers per second are blowing around HD 189 733b, an exoplanet located about 63 light years away from us. According to the researchers, the exoplanet's wind speed is about 7 times the speed of sound and is 20 times greater than the fastest wind speed ever known here on Earth. The scientists use data from the High Accuracy Radial Velocity Planet Searcher, or HARPS. It's a high-resolution spectrograph device at the European Southern Observatory's La Silla Telescope in Chile. The information allowed the researchers to gauge and map the planet's wind speed. They say it's the first time a weather system of a planet outside of our own solar system has been measured and mapped directly. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, it's known as Techie Heaven. It's the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Chinese regulators suspended trading on China's markets for a second time this week, Thursday, after markets nosedived more than 7%. The so-called circuit breaker measure, introduced by Chinese regulators following sharp declines in stock prices last June, kicked in just moments into the trading day. While conventional wisdom suggests it reflects investor concern over the weakening Chinese economy, falling world oil prices, and geopolitical tensions, Shane Oliver, chief economist at AMP Capital in Sydney, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it really is the circuit breaker mechanism itself that is causing investors to sell off unwanted shares quickly.
I think what we're seeing in the Chinese share market tells us more about the regulatory issues around the share market as opposed to what it's telling us about the economy. The economic data we've seen out of China recently, I would say, is mixed, whereas parts of last year it was actually negative. So I don't think it's really telling us much about the economy. But Monday was the first day of a new circuit breaker system for the Chinese share market. And that, of course, got triggered on Monday, the first day that it was introduced. And, of course, it got triggered again today. And I think what's happening here is that whenever there's some bad news or some worries, what's happening now is that Chinese investors think, well, I better sell early on if I'm going to sell at all, otherwise the circuit breaker will kick in and I won't be able to sell. So consequently, we're seeing the market pushed up to that level of a 7% decline each day, and that's causing the circuit breaker to then be triggered and the market to be shut down for the day. So in a way, it's become self-fulfilling.
Are you concerned that they'll impose this again in future selling?
My feeling is that regulators in China will probably review the circuit breaker. For example, there's a circuit breaker on the US share market, which has a pause in trading once the market falls 7% and then another pause when it falls 13%. And the market only shuts down when it hits a 20% decline. So there's a huge gap between those different levels. And, of course, I don't think the knowledge of the circuit breaker actually influences individual trading. So it would make sense, I think, for the Chinese authorities to review their circuit breaker, allow for the fact that it's a naturally more volatile market, and therefore change the thresholds to bigger levels, at least more in line with those seen in the US, for example.
Is the imposition of the circuit breaker feeding on itself and extending negative feeling? It really impacted the Chinese currency also.
I think there's no doubt that the circuit breaker is playing a role in actually enhancing volatility in the Chinese share market, whereas it was actually designed to dampen volatility. So it's having a perverse effect. It's becoming self-fulfilling in a way, which obviously wasn't anticipated when it was introduced. So the authorities were well-intentioned in introducing the circuit breaker, but probably need to have a closer look at the levels at which it kicks in.
That's Shane Oliver. He's chief economist at AMP Capital in Sydney. The Chinese government has also been guiding the yuan currency lower, an apparent sign that authorities are prepared to allow it to weaken in a bid to boost flagging exports. The yuan was set Thursday to trade at 6.5646 to the dollar, its weakest level in nearly 5 years. China's market volatility is also having a negative ripple effect across global markets. A decades-old tuna treaty between the United States and Pacific Island nations is in tatters after the American fleet backed out of a commitment to the number of days it wants to pay to fish. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
The non-payment of the fishing fees from the United States has wrecked 2017 national budget projections for such small nations as the Solomon Islands and the Marshall Islands, where the income is a critical component of their economies. James Movic is Director General of the Pacific Islands Forum Fisheries Agency, which is the administrator of the South Pacific Tuna Treaty.
An inconvenience, certainly, but it has the potential to become a real crisis.
Brian Hallman, the executive director of the American Tuna Boat Association, says owners are willing to pay the island states $40 million for annual fishing rights this year, far below the agreed $89 million under the treaty for more than 5,700 days of fishing.
From a very practical and very economic point of view, we just can't collect the money because boats are actually going bankrupt and boats are disappearing.
The Americans want to eliminate 2,000 fishing days they committed to for their 37 purse seiner vessels because prices nosedived below $1,000 a ton for skipjack tuna amid record-size catches. The American boats fish for tropical species, mostly skipjack, but also some big eye and yellowfin, composing a significant chunk of the annual $15 billion global canned tuna industry. None of the parties explicitly say the tuna treaty, which entered into force in 1988, is doomed, rather that significant modifications are unavoidable. The U.S. State Department acknowledges to VOA that the current treaty arrangements are not viable or sustainable in the long run, and a new framework for fishing access and environmental cooperation needs to be considered. The American boat owners received a shot to the bow in 2014 when Kiribati, with a population of only 100,000 people but controlling the most desirable tuna fishing waters, broke with the collective and began banning boats except from China and Taiwan. Some countries, such as New Zealand, advocate transitioning from the vessel day scheme, which has pushed up access fees charged by the islands, to a catch-based quota. But that is not something the island nations desire. Environmentalists also want to see the treaty modified to better protect species such as sharks and juvenile big eye, inadvertently scooped up in the purse seines, which are large walls of nets intended to catch entire schools of fish. John Hosovar is Oceans Campaign Director for Greenpeace USA.
If the U.S. is going to be tapping into U.S. tax dollars to subsidize these U.S. flagged tuna vessels, then we'd really like to see stronger leadership on conservation issues.
Having American boats fishing in the Pacific waters is preferable to those of other countries because, according to Hosovar, the U.S. government does a better job of enforcing violations and holding its flagged vessels accountable. The U.S. State Department says it is continuing to communicate with the island governments, hoping to reach a resolution amid financial challenges and changing economic conditions. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show is this week in Las Vegas, Nevada. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, virtual reality technology, robotics, super high definition televisions, and automotive concepts are on the agenda.
This year's Consumer Electronics Show is expected to highlight more of the Internet of Things, with devices and delivery systems taking center stage. Robin Raskin is the founder of Living in Digital Times. She says that the sprawling display of electronics shows that what was once fantasy is becoming reality.
Just from a year ago, it's like all the building block pieces have come together towards artificial intelligence, robotics, drones, driverless cars. That was all like sort of science fiction hype just a year ago at CES. Virtual reality, and this year it's all real. It's somewhat terrifying, but really exhilarating also.
One time, virtual reality was for gaming only, but now designers and manufacturers have used 360-degree cameras to give viewers a truly immersive real-life experience. Henry Stewart is the co-founder of Visualize, a London-based company that gives users views of events they could not have imagined just last year.
And we capture that by using 360-degree cameras that are essentially balls of cameras, different kinds of cameras for different jobs. And these all capture video at once. We then synchronize the cameras, stitch and blend all the content, and produce a sphere which you can then put into virtual reality in a virtual reality headset and immerse yourself in it and look around.
Stewart's company has produced videos that feature a rock band in concert, a passenger's eye view of a Lamborghini driving the coast of Italy, and what it's like from the outside of London's building, The Shard.
And so you've got this 36-hour time-lapse looking over London, seeing the clouds rush in, seeing the weather change, seeing the day and the night cycle, and it's really stunning. And so for The Shard, it means that they can go to tourism expos around the world and encourage tourism, you know, to visit and see this incredible view for yourself.
Robots are expected to make a big splash at this year's CES as well. In the past, many of the robots have been more toy-like, but Robin Raskin says designers are rolling out concepts for robots that are more like personal assistants.
And I'm thinking of an aging population saying, go get that bottle, or open this jar for me, or can you help me take my blood pressure? So you're going to see really useful robots, physician's assistant robots, articulating arms, manufacturing. So the practical uses of robotics, as well as the entertaining ones.
And auto lovers can look for the latest in automotive technology this week, including more advances toward driverless or autonomous cars. Faraday Future made a splash with its concept car, the FF01, which utilizes the company's variable platform architecture, the same undercarriage and batteries that can be modified for a variety of vehicles, from a race car to an SUV. Nick Sampson is Faraday's Senior Vice President of Research and Development and Product Development.
Over the past 18 months, we've assembled an extraordinary group of over 550 talented individuals in California, plus 200 more globally. We're working literally night and day to reimagine, rethink, and create an entirely new concept for mobility.
The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show runs through January 9th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's our show. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering rewards for information leading to six key leaders of the Somalia-based terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. The U.S. Secretary of State has authorized rewards of up to $6 million for information on the whereabouts of Abu Abeda Diriyah, up to $5 million each for information on Mahad Karate, Ma'alim Daoud, and Hassan Afguye, and up to $3 million each for information on Ma'alim Salman and Ahmed Imam Ali. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has killed thousands of civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers in Somalia, Uganda, and Kenya. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the July 11, 2010 suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda, which killed more than 70 people, including one American citizen. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the September 21st through 24th, 2013 terrorist attack against the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, which left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 wounded, and the April 2, 2015 attack on Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in 150 deaths. The U.S. Secretary of State designated Al-Shabaab a foreign terrorist organization on March 18, 2008. In February 2012, Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network jointly announced they had formed an alliance. Abu Abeda, also known as Diriyah, was named the leader of Al-Shabaab on September 6, 2014, after the death of former Al-Shabaab Emir Ahmed Abdi Al-Mohammed, otherwise known as Godanye. Mahad Karate, also known as Abdirrahman Mohammed Warsameh, has played a key role in Al-Shabaab's assassination operations in the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College. Ma'alim Daoud is responsible for Al-Shabaab's planning, recruitment, training, and operations against the government of Somalia and Western targets. Hassan Afguye oversees Al-Shabaab's financial activities, ranging from fake charities and fundraising to racketeering and kidnapping. Ma'alim Salman leads Al-Shabaab's African foreign terrorist fighters and has been involved in attacks against tourists, entertainment establishments, and churches in Africa. Ahmed Imam Ali has recruited Kenyan youth and raised funds for Al-Shabaab. Anyone with information on these terrorist leaders should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net. Individuals in North America can call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927.